You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz. Tony Duchesne here, and welcome to Drinks with Tony. We have a holiday screenwriting workshop. It's intensive, so during the holiday break, starting on December 22nd, you'll work for 2 to 3 hours a day to get from idea to fully detailed 50-scene outline of your screenplay. No experience necessary. Make good use of your holiday break to learn character development, the three-act structure, how to plot, and so much more. This is limited to 6 students, so sign up now before we are all filled up. Registration link at drinkswithtony.com. That's drinkswithtony.com to join my fast-paced screenwriting workshop happening in December during the holiday break. And now, on with the show.
Hi, I'm Chip Jacobs, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show. Yeah.
You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we got Chip Jacobs. Yeah. He's the author of Later Days, a novel. Chip, yes. Do you agree with me?
I agree with you, but you know, I thought you were going to spend on DoorDash a cocktail. So it really is Drinks with Tony.
You know, that would be a very film industry thing to do. I think they were doing that during award season during COVID, where you could watch the screener online, and then they'll send you a meal that would have been at the reception, so you could sit there and eat it alone. Sadly. As we were all going to die, but please vote for this actor.
Oh, I thought maybe they were going to send you some questionably mixed drink that got you so loaded. You thought garbage movie.
Well, the thing is, I've ruined this show because when I named it Drinks with Tony, I was drinking a lot more and guests were coming in the studio, and the second hour was a band. So there was always a case of beer by the time the band came in, and
my dog loved that idea. So can we go back to that? By the way, have you ever seen the YouTube show? I don't know if it's still going. It's called Getting Doug with High.
Yes. Oh my God. I haven't seen that in so long. Yeah. It was so good.
It was a brilliant idea. I wasn't always in love with the execution.
Yeah.
But there were some pretty great moments in it.
I realized that I like vulnerability and the anxiety of the possibility more than numbing myself before I talk to someone. You, I know, but sometimes it's a complete stranger. And I like to be in that space of this could go wrong. This could go severely wrong. And I have nothing that's numbing me to make it not hurt.
Yeah.
Or it could go great. And then I'm elated after without having anything that makes me forget how great it was.
That's a beautiful statement. But on the vulnerability side, that is one of the geniuses of the show, Hot Ones. You know,
yes. Why didn't I think of that?
I don't know. It was a foodie came up with it, and now it's a $1 million enterprise. But
yeah.
You know, getting people to drop their inhibitions because they can't come up with so much BS when they're worried their throat is going to close up from a level million sriracha sauce.
Yeah.
So I really like that show. And there will never be better one than seeing Conan O'Brien on that show.
Okay.
It is knuck and futz. And some of the celebrities are like tentative about taking a bite or wiping their eyes very carefully. Conan O'Brien just pretty much is like a pig in slop and just puts down hot sauce and rolls in it. Almost does that literally.
Wow.
See Conan O'Brien on Hot Ones. You will not be disappointed.
The brilliance of that simple concept is not only does it make the guest vulnerable, but I think we innately want to prove ourselves. It's almost like Survivor, but just with hot sauce. And we want not only to prove to the host, I'm saying it like we've been asked on the show, you know, maybe one of these days.
Where's my invite?
I know. One of these days, one of us might make it there and we'll watch the episode vigorously. But that's back to the human condition of just needing to get that, like, not only approval, but the win. We're so competitive. It's like, ooh, I gotta go to that next level because I can't drop out after Kevin Bacon dropped out. Because that guy was just an idiot when he was on this show. And I'm gonna be better than Kevin Bacon, which is what I wake up to every day. I say to myself, if you could be better than Kevin Bacon today.
Well, we're all we're all one degree of separation from Kevin Bacon.
Right.
Although I have people in Los Angeles that I think are even more Kevin Bacon than Kevin Bacon because everybody knows them. Anyway.
I was at Skylight Books. This is funny. This is about 2 years ago. I was at Skylight Books. And I was just standing there. And usually I don't get too starstruck. You know, sometimes I'm like, oh, that's cool. You know, because I live in LA now. So I'm just like, oh, that's cool. Right. That's how we all do it. I'm standing outside of Skylight and he walks out of Skylight and I go, Kevin Bacon. it just came out of my mouth because I'm like, how did that just happen? Except it's happening right face to face with me as I say it out loud. And he looks at me and he's like, I know the bells are going off.
Oh, yeah.
And usually I have the wherewithal to say, oh, I'm sorry, we haven't worked together. I just want to say hi. Because I know they're trying to go, oh, was this the camera setup guy on two movies ago or whatever? But all I did was say, Kevin Bacon. He just looked at me. He's all, he just kept walking. And then he turned around. He's like, kind of gave me it was almost like a generic, it was good to see ya. Maybe.
Please don't kill me.
or please don't kill me. I was embarrassed that I just blurted out his name right to his face because it was just so surreal.
In that case, you were 0 degrees of separation from Kevin Bacon.
we almost made out. We were so close.
I think actually in some ways you could actually go for him for alimony.
Well, I was thinking about that, but I just don't want to mess with our adopted kids.
You
got to think about the kids when you're in the middle of a divorce. So
Well, sorry about that, but that's a good story. In 2014, I went to see a solo show of one of the frontmen of Squeeze. Squeeze is one of my favorite bands.
Oh, okay. Which frontman?
Glenn Tilbrook.
Yeah, he's cool.
Yeah, he's an amazing musician. I will forever be Squeeze's unpaid PR person trying to get them into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But, you know, it wasn't a great part of my life, 2014. I was coming out of a dark period. Thank God I've been out of it. But I just really needed to see this solo show.
Yeah.
And he was traveling around the country on a bus, right? And doing the shows, he wasn't doing on a Squeeze tour. He came off the bus to go into the club. This is the Club Mint in Little Ethiopia. And I'm with some buddies and I just happened to catch him get off there. And I beelined up to him to shake his hand. And there was a little whiff of uncertainty, gratitude, and absolute terror. And went up in my mind is, oh my God, he thinks this is a Mark David Chapman moment. You know, and I will forever want to strangle that man for what he did to John Lennon. But then I went up to Glenn Tilbrook. It was like I was just trying to be all smiles. Oh, I'm not here to, put you on the front page of the New York Times as the next John Lennon. I just want to tell you how much your songs mean to me. You know, and I've been as a former journalist. I've been around a lot of famous people. I never get tongue tied. But around him, I could barely form a word. Him and Marcus Allen both just reduced me to a little unsure, insecure 6-year-old child. So anyway,
I think it's fantastic because everybody has that same thing. Even if they're famous, there is going to be somebody who tongue ties them as well when they meet them. So it's like no matter where we are on the stratosphere, There's always someone that will tongue tie somebody, and the Squeeze is doing an arena tour. I just saw. Did you see that?
Yeah, although you got to be careful if they are. I don't know. They have a massive contingent of cult fans here in America, and they're the best. When I later saw his show and came to get him to sign a CD, the word of warning: if you ever meet a musician, the thing you never want to say to them is, "I want to steal your song." That is what I came up with to tell Glenn Tilbrick. To honor him, he said, "I want to steal your song, labeled with love, for a short story." And the look of appreciation in his mind after he did the show and he's sweaty, having a glass of wine, turned flashed anger at me, like, steal? And I don't think Glenn Tilbrick's a guy that suffers fool gladly. And I just tried to dig my way out. And all I did, Tony, is I just kept digging the hole. I just kept digging the hole. And at the end, he took mercy on me. It's kind of like, that's okay. Let's take a picture. It's all okay. But never tell a musician, "I want to steal your song," even if
Yes.
in a complimentary manner.
And never tell a writer, can you read my screenplay?
Yeah. Or yeah, I've attached my book to this email. Can you get back to me by Monday what you think?
And that, and well, I there's a lot of how what como se dice? How do you say como, how do you say there's a lot of people with integrity who are trying to reach out and are excited to, and then
Yeah.
you just kind of let them do, usually 9 times out of 10 you go, hey man, I can't read this, but thanks, and I'm thank you for the nice compliments that you blah blah blah. And then there's that one time where the guy's just like, are you, who do you think you are? And you just get this long like email of disdain that's probably the best writing that person has ever done in their life.
Yeah.
And then
If
you're just
only your screenplay could be as good as my rejecting reading it. That's actually that's funny. I have a pathological inability to say no. When somebody wants me to read something, I'm honored they do, and I don't. I do
but you
tell
know
them.
them though too. It's these aren't strangers, right?
Well, most of the time, sometimes I've met people, friends of friends, and all of a sudden, "Hey, will you read this?" And then they just won't stop getting back to me. And I'm trying to do a good
Wow.
thing, but do I resent my elastic attitude? Yeah. And I'm cursing. Why did I say yes? But anyway, I do
You
try to
are
say
kinder than me. Everyone listening now,
or dumber.
send your
Yeah.
manuscript to Chip Jacobs at
Care of Tony Duchesne. Yeah. So,
right.
well, thank you for having me on. This is
It's
like
been great.
this has been like
it's
the best.
always
This has been
fun.
the this is like the softest parachute fun into an interview I've ever had.
Yes, thanks for coming on the show and have
You're
a great week,
welcome.
everyone.
Yeah, take care.
No. Chip Jacobs wrote Later Days, a novel. Chip, what, how did this book start?
That is, I've never had anyone ask me that. Somebody who
I
told me that
know.
question must be just
Should we just be honest?
that's a
We'll be
level.
honest right now. Before taping, Chip just said specifically asked that question, and I adore Chip, so I said that's a great idea.
Okay, and my dog told me to do it. So I don't know if we have a Son of Sam situation developing
If I
Pasadena.
didn't know you, I would have looked like Glenn
Yeah,
Tilbrook
labeled steal. Get the friggin' lawyers on you.
and
Probably around 2017, 2018, a friend of mine from prep school contacted me. I had not heard or even thought about him, honestly, since the late 70s. He, at our school, before he left, he was known as the Space Cadet of Flint Ridge Prep. Both, he had a reputation well earned as a stoner and as a genius. Stoner because he just came off like a little bit shorter version of Spicoli, and a genius because he could get an A coming down off whatever drug you could name and do it effortlessly. So in some ways, he reminded me of a California Spicoli version of Will from Good Will Hunting. Anyway, he
Wow,
saw
okay.
something
I
about
like
me.
I like that comparison. That's a
Yeah.
very specific, those are two very specific individuals to put
Yeah.
into one. I
Right.
love that.
If Spicoli and Matt Damon ever, had a love child, it would look a lot like my friend Tom Tookie. He saw a story about me in some small paper, like in Orange County, and said, "Oh my God, I have a thought of you. Let's get together." So we got together at a restaurant in Pasadena, a Thai restaurant. And he was everything that I remembered. Brilliant, insufferable, opinionated, a little insulting, and so charming. And type of guy that, you know, the type of guy I couldn't wait to debate the issues of the day next. We had like a 3-hour lunch at this Thai restaurant, and then I didn't hear from him for like 6 months. And I thought, typical friends, flaky, LA is filled with them. You know, your friend 1 minute and ghosted you the next. No, eventually he did call me back, Tony, and he said, I'm dying. I've been diagnosed with multiple myeloma. Can you help me write an apology letter? Okay.
Wow.
So again, my friend that I had lost touch with for decades, I'm dying of multiple myeloma. I don't have a lot of time left. Can you help me write an apology letter?
Yeah.
He had done something baked on some very heavy duty drugs after he got out of high school involving a gun and a wild animal that was a mirage. And he fired a bullet through somebody's window and they never forgave him. They never forgave him. And he carried this guilt around him.
So he only fired the bullet, didn't hit anything?
It didn't hit anybody, but it re-traumatized the family of the kid who went to prep with us, our high school, and was the most bullied kid in class.
Okay.
That kid thought that he'd survived it all and he'd overcome it and he was a better person. And lo and behold, one night, a bullet comes flying through their living room window, whizzes over his sister's head, and embeds itself in the wall.
Wow.
Make him think, it's a murder attempt? Is there a serial killer out? What's happening? From what I know, this family and this one former classmate withheld forgiveness of my friend. And that did a bigger number on him than the cancer.
Wow.
And sometimes things like that happen in life, you know, can weaken your immune system.
Yeah.
So on that sunshine note, that's how this book began.
Yeah.
To bring in another moody phrase. So my friend Tom moved from Huntington Beach to Pasadena. I did try to help him out before. I was thinking, I'm going to write a book about you. I was working on my first novel, Arroyo, which I came on your show to talk about before.
Right.
And
back when we were in person doing the interview.
Right. We went at that patio.
Yeah.
That cool restaurant. Is it in Silver Lake? Not Silver Lake.
Were we at the alcove? Cause I think I have a photo of me and you, and it's at the alcove.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry. My dog decides to chew her antler whenever I'm on an important Zoom. anyway, so she brings it right to my feet. So she gets in on the conversation.
Well, but anyway, you know, if she's got something to say, we dogs are allowed.
Say it.
So.
Say it. Exactly. Dogs have a voice. But eventually I got this idea, you know, a story about a guy trying to get an apology from the most bullied kid in class. And the idea that the persecuted become the persecutor for not showing the grace of accepting an apology. History is filled with that. And so I tried to get, you know, I'm going over to this guy's apartment. He's separated from his family. He doesn't have a long time to go. He's worried about his finances. Then it turned into.
Why was he separated from his family? Was it just a distance thing or were they not talking to him and he was also dying?
He told me they had left him. But in effect, he left them because he was going through a psychological crisis, couldn't handle it. And, you know, he had a loving wife and very young daughter that wanted to be with him. In the end, they reunited. But he was alone at this moment. And it was really on him. Not that I knew it at this time. He told, you know, he spun a different story. But I'm trying to help him. Some other friends have been trying to help him.
Yeah.
And then it came the movie Almost Famous by Cameron Crowe. In Almost Famous, a young Cameron Crowe, who did work for Rolling Stone, is trying to get a rock star he's covering to sit down and tell him the story of his life.
Yeah.
It's really based on Cameron Crowe and Led Zeppelin. You know, and I, as a real Rolling Stone fanatic, you know, I think the line of his Cameron Crowe's real article says, I'm on a plane with the world's hottest band, and we're about to die. The plane was having troubles. In this case, Tom was so busy trying not to die, and maybe even come up with a way to tell me a story that was more sympathetic to him, that his psyche could more sympathetic than a psyche would allow. You know, he would never say, okay, I was born here. This is where my problems began. I had bipolar. I got addicted. This is how that gunshot happened. It never did. And so I'm not going to press the guy. I mean, I was trying to help him, give him a little money, you know, prepare myself for another death.
Yeah.
You know, when it felt like there was a lot of death around me at this time. And when he died, I eventually went to his widow and his daughter and his best friends and others, and they filled in what my friend Tom could not. So in a way, it kind of became a beautiful piece of teamwork where they were enabling me to do what I could. And I've tried to help out his family where possible. So it was a very strange call to say, help me write an apology letter. But I use that as the foundation of the book. And so the book, later in the book, becomes about my friend trying to get an apology. And
so, you did write the apology, and did it get to the person?
No,
it my, never got.
My, no, friend Tom died, and so I wrote the book became my way of giving Tom the apology he wanted me to write.
Wow.
True. It is true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you feel when because that feels like a book carries a lot of weight. How do you feel when it has a lot of responsibility?
Yeah. You mean like if somebody from one of the families involved came?
No,
to you?
No. I'm not talking about like litigiously. I'm just talking about the weight of the weight of something like that. Like that would spin me around a bit where I would be, I mean, I get easily not confused, conflicted anyway. I'm a constant conflict. And so I get conflicted about things with even lesser weight that I'm trying to get out there, but something with that kind of weight and that kind of, where it's just like, wow, like this is for, what is his name? Tom? This is because of Tom. It's for Tom. And this is to go out to the world to everybody that has been Tom or was Tommed.
Actually, I didn't feel weight. I felt I felt responsibility, and I felt motivation. You know, so the book isn't just about him. It's about our time at this very Lord of the Flies prep school that went co-ed my senior year.
Yeah.
Okay. So we had 37 boys. Well, one
God
class
bless the ladies.
Yes, but
entree, you know, mademoiselle.
Yes, but you know, we were welcoming in a superior sex, and you know, you'd be surprised what it did to the testosterone pyramid. I interviewed like crazy. You know, this is where being a reporter in the past helped.
Oh,
you know,
interesting. Okay,
I interviewed my friends. You know, I made characters on them. I interviewed Tom's widow, his daughter, who's great. His childhood best friend that filled me in on the real version of him before they even knew him.
Yeah.
So you know, I put that together, and much of the book is really true. You know, in the back end, the stuff that happened is pretty close to reality with things moved around. And
right. So was there a point where you thought, you know, I need to make this a nonfiction and then flipped
Never.
It to novel? No.
Never.
Okay.
Nope.
And what was, and why do you think that was?
Because I wanted to have the room to bring in my own imagination, other themes, you know, create a different backstory for the school, a different backstory for myself.
Yeah.
Now, I needed to prosecute the case against my own father, who, you know, did many wonderful things for me and some things that probably weren't so fantastic. And I needed to get a lot out. And writing a memoir made my friend Tom too much a side character and made me a martyr. I want to be the observer who's troubled himself, you know, and in trying to save somebody, I'm also trying to save my own self-belief.
Yeah. And I love that about novels, because that's where I feel like novels are do the thing that's the emotional truth. That we get to it, that we get to a core and layers that where if we just go, oh, this fact happened, this fact happened, this fact happened. Yes, that's nice. Wow, that's cool. We know. But on a novel level, it's almost like getting to digging deeper into the subconscious as the writer and even as the reader, where we don't even know what strings are being pulled. It's a different game, writing and being a reader of novels.
No doubt. You know, my first novel, you know, it's the first bit of fiction I ever did. I got lucky with Arroyo, but I wanted to make it big, sweeping, and weird. I wanted this to be emotional, raw. And my own character in this book, Tony, where I saw there was a little wound on my character's body. I'm Luke in the book. I just took a knife and just jabbed it right into that and broke the scab and just turned it. And I would have gone even deeper if I could, but I wanted to really expose my own darkness, my own self-doubt, and my own quest to understand why am I here, you know? And
were you in therapy too at the time or no? Because like with books like that, I got to be in therapy. Actually, with books like that, I got therapy this week. So.
I'm not in therapy, but I probably could have used it. You know, I wrote about the death of my childhood dog. That got me through a lot of hard times. And this is true. The dog died shortly before I took my SATs. Going to a school whose main goal is to prepare you for the SATs. And I was kind of a basket case when I took them. I was still grieving. Now we know about therapy and more about the architecture of the mind when it gets depressed. You know, back then it was suck it up, wipe away your tears and focus, buckle down. But I almost needed a new keyboard from crying on it so much, writing that scene about the dog.
Yeah.
Because it's vivid. It just stuck with me.
Yeah.
You know, and I think my dog is up there in the afterlife waiting for me to come down. And I think it maybe wanted to put a paw on me to say, it's okay, man. You know, don't tremble so much. So that was my therapy. It talked about my dad, you know, my mom's. So, you know, by making it a novel, I could make the characters better serve my own arc rather than more messy, unfathomable reality. I don't mean to bum you out, but I had to go to some dark places.
Chip, you don't have to apologize, because what we do here is we get vulnerable.
I saw it made you a little sad, but you know, losing
it's okay to be sad. And later today, I'll be happy. I go through these feelings, and thank you for bringing me through these feelings.
That's why the book could only be called Later Days, because that was such a common phrase in the late 70s.
I know.
I'm a little bit older than you. No. So Later Days was, when somebody said Later Days to you, you knew you were dealing with a Spicoli type of psyche or a very California mindset. And it was both Later Days. It was both a promise and a threat in a way.
Oh really? Okay. Well, how was it a threat? Because when I think of later days,
like a threat of good times to come, and if you're not there, it's, you know, it's going to be bygone days. I don't know.
Oh
but
yeah,
it was
yeah.
It was a it had a special magic, that phrase, and my friend did say that.
Yeah.
And it's been weird because, you know, I didn't know him through many periods of his life. Other people that knew him before we reconnected have reached out, and some of them have had some little, there's been some nuance of how dare you? How dare you write about him?
Interesting.
How dare you say that? But I'm writing about somebody based on somebody.
Right.
You know, and creating a story about his family, it's largely not true. And a story of my own self in the book, that's largely not true. But there's enough reality in it. So people would get, okay, I see this is not just unmoored from sanity, you know?
Yeah.
So it's very important that it was a well-done blend of fiction and hard, fun, you know, memories of those days.
Yeah.
So most of my book takes place in 1979, 1980. We jump ahead 20 years and we're seeing what these prep school kids that are going to change the world for the better, where they are, you know? But it doesn't linger at the reunion. It lingers into the friendship of the two estranged people, my friend Tom and my character.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what's now the character is named Tom as well?
No, it's his real name was Tom Tookie in the book. I love that alliteration. So I named him Danny Drummond.
I like that.
I just like
that's the same music.
It did. And so my name in it is Luke Burnett. But when I quit the football team in the book, my best friend calls me Luke Pukewalker because I threw up before I quit the team, which is true. So, you know, there's,
oh, there are many worse names that you could get, but Pukewalker is not bad.
But, you know, one of the big sources for my book was going back and look at my yearbook. You know,
oh yeah,
and I went to a high school that was filled with really smart, creative, and sometimes troubled kids. But man, they took irony to an art form, and I can't believe the administration let us put stuff in there that got in there. But that just reminded me of who we were, the language we used. It was filled with all types of offensive terms today that would get you canceled. You know, I didn't go heavy on them, but I was authentic to the times. And you know, you realize back then when you went to an all boys school, if you liked somebody, you insulted them. If you didn't like them, ignored them, or pretended that they were, you know, a member of some, you know, like near Cro-Magnon subgroup of human. So you know, that is how we related to each other. You know,
well, I think that's a dude thing,
and we never talked about our troubles. We
just insulted,
lived for the hour, and never went into, oh, my mom's an alcoholic. My dad left my mom. I think my sister's in the nest. I think I saw a serial killer drive by. You know, we just closed in, insulted, and protected each other.
I think the insultings and a little bit of bullying is good in the developing years, especially for boys. It's like boys are puppies, man. They gotta bite until it kind of hurts a little too much, and then they yipe. You know how
there was a lot of yelping at our school. One of the things about when I was going back writing the book, you know, inside the classroom, overall the teachers had excellent control over us squirrely kids.
Mm-hmm.
There was occasionally threats of corporal violence, and there was some corporal violence of people getting hit like with the handle of a putter or a paddle or stuff. But generally, they really had us eight boys well controlled inside the classroom. When the bell rang, it was every boy for themselves, because I don't know where those teachers and administrators went. I think they went into a portal to the faculty coffee lounge, because we walked those hallways unsure if a hand was going to grab us for a squirrely, a atomic wedgie, you know, if you make worse fates. And it was very confusing dynamic.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then the bell rang and we were back to being normal again.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, it was both feral and it was both erudite. So, you know, duality of the children of late 70s La Quinceañera.
Yeah. And also the faculty lounges always bellowed with smoke.
That's
I for some odd reason, the only faculty lounge I remember is when I was in elementary school. And that my teachers had their packs of cigarettes on the desk, and they and it was like they were you know, looking back now, they were waiting for that moment to have their time of meditation with that tobacco, right, with the other teachers, and just having it on the desk while they were looking at us dreary, you know, smelly kids.
Then
it's just like, oh man, 15 more minutes and I get to kiss your filter, man.
Oh yeah, that's right. I know, there's no doubt about that. It was an interesting school, and you know, when you're a freshman, you in lower grades, you just look up to the adults, and they kind of rule by terror and authority, and you know, you believe in them, and they are, you want to think they are looking out for you and want to see you the very best you can be. But by the time you're a senior, especially at an ironic, iconoclastic school, they've lost their godlike status, and we're seeing them really as flawed human beings, including their personal lives. And that happened at our school, you know, and in the end, you know, we became them. So somebody is looking at us once through adoring eyes and now through more jaundiced eyes.
Yeah.
But I feel like I got a little taste of the world when I was a senior, seeing, okay, this person that is run our universe is troubled, or he doesn't have a good marriage, or he may be drinking too much and need some help. And that was a real thing. And, you know, I'm sure I'm not the only one, but you kind of wake up by the time you're a senior.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes I feel like I kind of woke up yesterday and I was like, oh, wait a second. That's how the universe works. And tomorrow I'll be wrong again. But speaking of how the universe works, we also have to talk about your experience of the tree.
Yes.
Now, do you remember this?
Of course.
Because this is, I was just like, oh my God, that happened to you, Chip.
Yeah.
When are we talking about it on the show?
Yeah, so thank you for asking about that. And I just got an essay in Writer's Digest where I explained a little more. But yeah, the book started off with somebody saying, help me write an apology letter while I still have time.
Yeah.
The book ended with Time saying to me, I think your time is almost up. The night before the Eaton fires, or the night of the Eaton fires, as you remember, were you here?
Yeah, I was. So that, and then for the listeners that don't know, we're talking about the Los Angeles fires. So when we say Eaton, we're talking about Altadena, Pasadena area, where it was bad. It was bad. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So we had two fires here. One was started in Eaton Canyon, where I grew up, and I had nothing to do with the fire. And it was funny that not funny, but. Interesting. One of the
I love forest fires when they kill people. Go ahead. I love fires when they take out the Pacific Palisades. Okay, go ahead.
Atomic war disease. It's all great.
Oh my God! Disease, plague, violence.
I know. This is why aliens are going. We're passing on. What's in the Andromeda?
Right. Hey, I'm putting my thumb out for those aliens. Right here. Just one. Come on,
just
let's go.
Non-toxic contact. But yeah, so interestingly enough, they thought the incriminating evidence against Edison, Southern California Edison, was taken by an Arco station video camera, very close to where I grew up in Eaton Canyon, right off Altadena Drive. And I practically grew up in that Arco station, Tony. Going into that stuff, you know, as a teenage driver trying to hide dents on the station wagon, drunk, high, having a fight with my parents, in mortal crisis with a girlfriend.
Wow.
So, and it's like, that's my gas station. And then it turned out that I don't think that was quite the smoking gun people thought. But the night of the Eaton fires was, and the day of it, I think it started like at 7 o'clock at night. It was very, very windy here, like hurricane level winds.
Yeah.
80, 90 miles an hour. We live in West Pasadena near the Rose Bowl. A neighbor's tree, eucalyptus tree, that had long been a source of fear of mine, not to mention nuisance because of all the crap it dropped. It was probably a tree with the whose trunk was the width of a 747 engine. It was probably seven stories high, based on what I know, 6-7 tons. I'd always worried, oh my God, if this thing falls, it is a killer. If it hits somebody's roof, it's gonna, people are dead. Well, lo and behold, about 6 o'clock the night of the fires, we had yard work that day, much to my paranoia about somebody getting hurt, but and it knocked out our outdoor lights. I was about to go out to the corner of my yard, to a little garden shed where I hang out every night with my dog and decompress after writing, to gauge the level of hazard and think about, do I need to go talk to the neighbors or do we need to move to the other side of the house? But something grabbed me, something not physical, but something almost like psychological and unfathomable. Said, go back to your desk and work on your book. There's something not right with your book. You know, I had like two more months to turn it in after, you know, to do final edits. Mm-hmm. I swear to you, it was like massage that book. And I went back out to my keyboard while the wind is howling like crazy. And I'm still thinking about that tree. But then the book sucked me back in, because when you're a perfectionist, as all writers are, you get horse blinders on. And the lines I focused in on the book, I swear to God, were this. I needed to create a better description of the effect of hormones on the average teenage boy. So I called it teenage horndoggery. Teenage horndoggery.
That's you know, good. Like, That's
like,
good.
Like any literary master.
Yes.
Like, I'm a big fan of John Irving. You think John Irving would debase himself saying teenage horndoggery or Philip Roth? But anyway, I wrote that in there. You know, I was probably in here like half an hour. I came back out and sat with my wife, and like minutes later, our house shook like at a foundational level. And I did say in my thing, it's like you could feel it in your bones.
Yeah.
Sure enough, Tony, we went out there. Remember, there's no lights out. It's pitch black. The wind is howling and swirling, and I'm worried about branches coming down. My wife and I took our iPhones out there, and it was like Manhattan had fallen, but it wasn't Manhattan that had fallen. It was the killer eucalyptus tree, and it had fallen mainly in my yard, parallel to our property line, and blew up the storage shed, this garden shed where I go hang out, like King Kong stepping on a shoebox.
Wow.
I mean, if I had been in there when the meat of that tree hit, I'd be gone. This book would be on the New York Times bestseller list, because all these people would go, oh my God, this brilliant book by a writer that's no, I mean, I probably should have faked my own death, but kidding aside.
I'm glad all writers think about this, because I think about, like, oh wow, well, if I die and this current book I'm querying doesn't get out, well, at least that'll be the publicity everyone needs.
That is right. That is how shameless and awful we are. But we went out there, and the tree was so big, its limbs stretched like halfway towards our house.
Wow.
I mean, the tree probably missed hitting the roof line by maybe 30, 40 feet.
Yeah.
And it also missed even closer another family near us with little kids. And
did your wife know that you should have been out there at that time?
I told her later.
Okay.
And my anxiety raced up from my central nervous system up into my throat. I was afraid. I mean, my heart was beating so fast. Once I put all the pieces together, it's like, wait, I could have been out there had I not been here. And then I just went and I started kind of not spiraling downwards, but, you know, almost kind of like getting a little breathless, thinking, was that divine intervention? Was that coincidence? Yeah. Am I trying to create this martyr portrait of myself that, you know, is this literary person that got saved so this book could come out? I don't know. But I was shaken. And I even tried to jump on our treadmill just to kind of work out some of the yips. And I went my 10 minutes, I can't do it. I can't do it. I'm spinning around. So eventually we got evacuated the next day. And when I came back, before I was supposed to, because I was worried about this tree catching an ember and the whole neighborhood burns down, I realized, you know, I that wasn't just a quick analysis. I would have been smoked. I would have been pancaked.
Right.
Dog worse. At least I would have gone to the afterlife with my dog, but she wouldn't deserve that. That tree had my name on it.
Yeah.
And God, you know, thank God for teenage horndoggery. So it's kind of been a death bookended novel writing process.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was divine intervention. Was it my guardian angel? Was it my friend from the afterlife? Was it my grandmother who I think saved my butt before? I don't know. And in a way, I'm just, whoever it is, thank you for letting me keep breathing. And it was gnarly. And it did harden my resolve to make this book a success, do good things with it, try to help people. Part of the book does deal with near-death experience. You know, in the later parts of the book, Denny is a hardcore atheist, which my friend Tom wasn't. But can you imagine an atheist who is very articulate and a loose cannon going into a near-death experience support group and telling people, near-death experience, there is, after death, you're nothing but worm food. So forget this spiritual voyage. It's a one-way trip into the ground. So I have him cause, you know, chaos and upset at this meeting. I try to do it in a comedic way.
Yeah.
But then it was weird. You know, I write about near-death experience and I just have my own. So it became, I told somebody, a writer friend, became like a metafiction feedback loop.
See, I understand that. And that scares me sometimes, because sometimes I feel like when I write, It's all it the it's I realize that it's I mean a lot of our writing we realize later, oh wait, my subconscious like drove a lot of that because I would have never been able to get there. And now after I finished it or even after it's published, and you get more epiphanies. I get more epiphanies where it's
You
like, oh my God, I wrote that because of blank and blank, and I was dealing with blank. That makes so much sense.
Yeah.
And I just finished this whole book about the afterlife, how this guy and in the beginning, he dies because he's crying on a bicycle after his girlfriend breaks up with him, and he smashes his head into a Buddha statue on the sidewalk. So at first he thinks there's Buddha, and the after it's Buddha, and it's just like,
Yeah.
we're not so sure about that anyway. And
Yeah.
then carry on, hilarious comedy that you'll be seeing in 2027 or 2028, the way this
Count me in.
publishing industry goes, but.
Right.
I got a little scared for a little bit after I finished it because I was like, did I just foretell my own death? And I started to spiral a little bit on that. And I'm like, wait, because I know that character is me somewhat, but yet not, but yet is. And I just wrote about a dead guy. And that kind of scared me. It doesn't scare me anymore. I feel more removed from it, but I was just like, did I just put out to the energies of my own conscious, subconscious, the collective conscious, the collective subconscious, the neurons into outer space dust. Did I just like start something or no?
But if you did, you just disproved the idea there is death. What is death? Death is a five-letter word. I do
In
think,
English.
well, that's true. But
I'm just.
supposedly Constantinople, or wait, Constantine, had taken out of the book some reference to resurrect to reincarnation. Do you know that? It could just be a great myth.
Oh, are
You
you
know.
talking about the Bible?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So,
Supposedly, I need to read. I need to learn more of my biblical history, but I feel every book I write is going to be attacking death as a myth, a myth that pollutes and distracts us from the reality. We all go on. Jim Morrison, whatever you think of him, was absolutely wrong. We all get out of here alive. It just looks still, but the second that you're still in this body. You're back home where you've always been, and somebody once said, some not psychic, but a religious muse said, you're just waking up. You've been here all along. You just came out of your dream. So I do feel very strongly every book is going to, of mine, every novel is going to be going after that idea. And somewhere or another's, I really, in later days, I wanted a character. Who was a well-known public figure in real life to sort of address that in their own way. And I came up with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross did not only come up with the five stages of death, she was rewarded, I think, by her creator for being at the bedside of thousands of dying patients, telling them the truth, being loving and caring and saying, unburden yourself. Don't listen to these doctors. Just accept it. And then she started having her own near-death experience visions, one after the other after the other. And there is no doubt to me, God was saying, you've paid with your service. Now I'm going to show you where the reward is. And I mean, it's out of her own books. And I'm such a fan of her. And I wanted to resurrect her for my story and to help Denny. Try to figure out what does mortality mean.
That
So.
I so I because I had a near-death experience when I was 21, I think 21, 22, and I had been bleeding in my esophagus for like a week. I had no clue. I just couldn't eat. Like
Wow.
everything for a week, I was just like, I couldn't even stomach it, and it was because blood was in my stomach.
Yeah.
And I was on Market Street in San Francisco, walking with a friend to go see the Violent Femmes and the Meat Puppets. This was probably
Okay.
1991, 1990, yeah, 1991, late 1991. And I was just not feeling well. And I'm like, when I get there, I'm just gonna get like a double shot of vodka to set my head straight because something's wrong. The next thing I know, I go, wait, something's wrong, and I go to reach out to my friend, and then the next thing I know, I'm being screamed at by paramedics because I'd been out, and then they were like, "What's your name? What's your name?" And I went back out of consciousness again. When I was in and out of consciousness, I was on a canoe on a lake, and just at the most peace I like had ever felt in my life. And then the minute they were bringing me back, it would deluge overboard, and then I was back, and everything was hurting, and it was just hurt, screaming, screaming. I just wanted the screaming to stop because it was them trying to keep me alive. And then I was boom, I was back on that boat, and it was so visceral that the lake, the boat. And it's just like, and I'm like, was this my brain giving me like messages saying, it's like, hey, this is death time. Now I'm gonna like soothe you into it, or was this something else? And you know what? I don't have an answer, but also I'm not a skeptic in any way at all about this stuff. I'm like going that, yeah, that might have been a thing. That really might have been a thing.
It very well might have been. I don't know, but during COVID, when I was starting to get the idea for this book, I use every lunchtime as an excuse to watch two or three near-death experience videos. And I haven't heard one like yours, but if you watch enough of them, you see the system of our souls is so much bigger than the no limited number of words Jesus spoke or Buddha or Muhammad. It's all beautiful. It's all overlapping. It's all about love. And it's not just the body's response to a traumatic injury. No, there's too many people are having universal experiences that boil down to four or five. You're going through a tunnel, you're in darkness, and you go through a pinpoint of light and it expands out. You're in a magical place like you. You're seeing people that are dead before you even heard they had died, or you're learning things impossible. So, I hope that filled you with reassurance and not fear, and go, there's a bigger system out there. That's all. It's the Tony soul development,
Well,
kind
to go further
of.
along in that story, they realized that I needed a blood transfusion, and I was still a Jehovah's Witness at the time. So I was like, absolutely not. When they got me stabilized, we always had to carry our paperwork with us, our no blood transfusion. This absolves you of any legal
Liability.
from right. And I was like, look at my pocket there, and then I would be out, and I'd be unconscious again, and they would get me stabilized again, and there would be a different doctor, and one doctor said, hey, look, it takes us a while to process the blood, and things are getting like tight right now. So we're going to go ahead and process the blood and get it ready just in case you change your mind, because you are going to die
For
if
sure.
it's not there. And I told him I'd rather die. That's how deep my faith was in the Jehovah's Witnesses, where I faced death for the Jehovah's Witnesses and for myself at the time. So that's how like deep the faith was. Part of me is pretty impressed that I was that deep in the faith. The other part was there were so many people that doubted me as a Jehovah's Witness. They couldn't believe that I wasn't I was just young and good looking. They couldn't believe that I wasn't banging every girl, and they couldn't believe that I had not sinned before God. And I was just I had not, and when that came up, all of a sudden, all these elders who had been interrogating me for years finally went, "Oh, I think he did something that maybe I'm not even sure I can do."
Yes, that's
And
right.
I was kind of like, "You dickheads!" After that, I was just like, "Don't even
Yeah,
look.
you so
Don't
believe
even
it.
look at
What's
me.
their best
Don't even
customer?
look me in the eye. I got the faith."
That's heavy. I went to a
So
Christian science. I went to a
the.
Christian science school, so I kind of know what you're talking about.
I'm sorry.
I went to a Christian science school where
Oh,
they,
okay.
if you were bleeding, they would pray over the blood.
Were your
But
parents
it's funny,
Christian
the blood.
scientists?
No, it was because of a federal court ruling that desegregating Pasadena schools, the public school I went to kicked us out, and my parents had to find me a private school on the fly, and I went to Claiborne in San Marino. And anyway, that was Yeah, something. I had my own experience, not like yours, where I got hit in the nose at 7 or 8 by a pop fly that I tried to catch with my bare hands, and I was terrified seeing all the blood coming out of my nose. I didn't have enough blood to survive. And asking my mom, am I gonna do I haven't do I need more blood or you know? And she reassured me, and that night I had a vision of my room. But as I later learned, people in my family were always, things like this happened to my family a lot, where the departed come back in dreams, where they leave physical manifestations that say destination arrived. And, you know, I get very frustrated with atheists on TV that say, we've seen no evidence of God, when there's literally libraries and stories and anecdotes and research information that would fill libraries. But because it's not in a lab and you can't recreate you know, a soul leaving the body, it's not scientifically worthy. It just infuriates me. And I just wish I wish we had a way to tell people, just to, what does your senses tell you? What does your instinct tell you? Believe, like, what did that story about the canoe teach you in the end, Tony? What is the lesson you drew from it?
Well, I think I continue to draw lessons every single day. So that feels, at the time, I didn't know what the lesson was, but I knew that I felt good about my faith resolve at the time. Little did I
Yes.
know that that faith would crack and break like 10 years later and really spin me into a dark place. But the idea of atheism, I just said this to someone and they were just like, they thought I was insane, but I was just like, you know, if you're an atheist, you got more faith than probably most born again Christians, because atheism comes from the faith of not, and the faith of
That's
not
right.
is faith.
That is right. That's actually brilliant. Yeah. So yeah. So to an atheist. So let me just get this right. Now they believe there could be infinite universes. So let me just get this straight. All of this came from nothing, random.
Yeah, that
Wow.
I do
That's
not believe.
what
There
I'm
is,
saying. That's what they that's what they believe. And
yeah.
I know this sounds patronizing and broad brushing, but I think behind many atheists is somebody that it's not that they don't believe in God, they're just angry at what God created for them in their life and
Oh,
the
don't get me
handmaiden.
wrong. I'm angry at God. I chatted with Chip Jacobs for another 15 minutes or so. Sorry for the smash cut there. If you'd like to hear the rest of the chat, go on as we talk about spirituality, his book, and how we choose our parents. Can you believe that? And more. Go to drinkswithtony.com and just fast forward to this 56-minute mark. And a reminder, we're capping the holiday screenwriting workshop to 6 students, which means it's time to register for the 2-week accelerated workshop that I usually teach at UCLA Extension for a huge discount. And it's instead of 3 months, it's going to be 2 weeks. We set aside 2 to 3 hours per day throughout the holiday break to go from script idea to detailed outline. A link for registration is available at drinkswithtony.com. That's the holiday screenwriting workshop. Let's work on a screenplay during the holiday break. No experience necessary. Just show up and do the repetitions, and you'll be amazed at how fast an idea turns into characters and a 3-act structure and an amazing plot. I'll guide you every step of the way. The registration link is at drinkswithtony.com. Happy Thanksgiving. I'll see you next week.
Quand le jazz est, quand le jazz est là, la java s'en va. Il y a de l'orage dans l'air, il y a de l'eau dans le gaz entre le jazz et la java. Chaque jour un peu plus, il y a le jazz qui s'installe. Alors la rage au cœur, la java fait la malle. Ses petites fesses en bataille sous sa jupe fendue. Elle écrase sa gauloise et s'en va dans la rue. Quand le jazz est, quand le jazz est là, la java s'en va. Il y a de l'orage dans l'air, il y a de l'eau dans le gaz entre le jazz et la java. Quand j'écoute Béat en solo de batterie, v'là la java qui râle au nom de la patrie. Mais quand je crie bravo à l'accordéoniste, c'est le jazz qui m'engueule me traitant de raciste. Quand le jazz est, quand le jazz est là, la java s'en va. Il y a de l'orage dans l'air, il y a de l'eau dans le gaz entre le jazz et la java. Pour moi jazz et java c'est du pareil au même. Je me saoule à la Bastille et noircie à Harlem. Pour moi jazz et java dans le fond c'est tout comme. Quand le jazz dit gomène, la java dit gomme. Mais quand le jazz est, quand le jazz est là, la java s'en va. Il y a de l'orage dans l'air, il y a de l'eau dans le gaz entre le jazz et la java. Jazz et java copains, ça doit pouvoir se faire. Pour qu'il en soit ainsi, tiens, je partage en frère. Je donne au jazz mes pieds pour marquer son tempo. Et je donne à la java mes mains pour le bas de son dos. Et je donne à la java mes mains pour le bas de son dos.